In the last week, we brought you one of the chief economists at the New York School of Business saying we're going into a probable depression. We're already in a deep recession. We brought you Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, father of Reaganomics, former head of Treasury. Also, Wall Street Journal editor saying basically the same thing. Joseph Stiglitz, Nobel Prize winner, former chief economist, World Bank. They're all basically saying the same thing, and we're bringing you another individual. We're just bringing you all the top names. It's hard now to find, you know, actual people that have had good track records that aren't saying we're going into a serious, deepening recession and maybe even a depression. And we've got John Williams from ShadowStats.com, who does just an amazing job. I've been following him for the last few years, and many others for a lot longer than that, at forecasting what's really happening in the economy, extracting real numbers, and kind of reverse engineering the disinfo that the government agencies and both parties are putting out about the economy. This is what CNN was saying about Mr. Williams the other day.
John Williams at ShadowStats.com says about what's coming down the road.
Where are we going? We have a severe recession ahead of us with even higher inflation than we're seeing now. It's going to be probably the worst business cycle seen since the Great Depression. I wouldn't want to be the president in the 2012 election, because whoever wins this upcoming one is going to take blame for a real bad economy.
So with that kind of a prediction, do you hear that? An inflationary depression is coming down the road. And my question was wow, what do we do? I'm not the kind of guy that gets on the air and tells people what to do. But listen to what John Williams says, and he makes these predictions to Fortune 500 companies and hedge funds around the country. This is a guy who gets paid for his advice, and we're lucky enough to get him on CNN to tell you what to do with your money. Listen to what he says you should do.
It's a bad time for stocks. It's a bad time for bonds because of the higher inflation and what's going to be weakness in the dollar. That will tend to push the long-term rates higher, pressing down on bond prices.
Sell stocks.
Very simple. Cash. You want to be liquid. You want to be safe. And I'd hold a little bit of gold as a hedge against inflation.
Now, you know what Robert Shiller at Yale University, the famous economics professor up there who does the Kay-Shiller Report,
sure.
Amazingly, he says the same thing. So does Nuriel Roubini over at NYU, saying the same. These aren't a bunch of kooks. These are guys who are educated. These are guys who are looking far out into the economy that say, look out, there's a big pie coming in your face.
Crowley. Craig, let me ask you a question. I was listening, the other day when President Bush made his speech, Ben Bernanke was testifying before Congress for a second day. I was listening to Bernanke speaking. Senators were asking about inflation. Everybody in America, certainly in Texas, spent this week talking about inflation and how serious it was in 2007 and how bread and milk and cheese and gas and all of that is more expensive. And Ben Bernanke, with a straight face, said to Congress, no, core inflation is quite contained. In fact, it's under 3%. Core inflation, as we've all talked about, is inflation that...
All right, going back to John Williams, who you just heard from ShadowStats.com. John, do you want to get into how they cook the stats first, or do you want to just get into the forecast of where you see this country going?
Well, let me get into how they cook the stats, because that, I think, affects the credibility of where I believe they are and where we are going. Again, there are actually two types of manipulations. The one which has the greatest impact over time is where their methodological change is made and the way the numbers are put together. And the second way is where you have an occasional direct manipulation aimed at changing a particular number for political purposes or otherwise. To give you an example, in the first case, with the consumer price index, very key point, really the most insidious change I've seen in any of these numbers, goes back before Bill Clinton. Michael Boskin, who was chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors under Bush, and Alan Greenspan, then the Fed chairman, started arguing about how the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, was overstating inflation. And if you listen to their arguments, what they were saying is, well, the inflation measure reflects the price of steak, but let's say steak goes up too much in price, people are going to start buying hamburgers. So really, the price of steak goes up, we should replace steak with hamburgers, and that would give you a more reasonable estimate of the cost of living. That's not the concept of the Consumer Price Index. If you go back to the after World War II, the consumer price index goes way back in time. But when the CPI was used in the auto union contracts, the concept, very simply, and I'm being very simplistic here, would be, let's say we take the price of a gallon of milk, a steak, a loaf of bread, maybe a gallon of gas, we price those out. The next year, we price those same commodities out, and you compare the prices, and that's how much your income had to go up if you wanted to maintain a constant standard of living. The concept was, what's my cost of living of maintaining a constant standard of living? What they were proposing pre-Clinton is shifting to a basis that's where the weightings are based on substitution. So that steak goes up, you replace it with hamburgers. That's not maintaining a constant standard of living. That's really more a cost of survival. And what was not the concept behind the CPI, and obviously it's much lower. If something goes up in price and you replace it with something that's of lower quality in price.
So they should call it the survival price index.
Yeah. Now, they didn't actually put it into full play the way Boskin and Greenspan were advocating. And the reason they gave for this was, oh, my goodness, you know, if we only could bring down the cost of the level of the CPI, we could reduce entitlement payments on or the cost of living adjustments on Social Security and such. That was their purpose behind it, which would be a way of reducing Social Security payments without anyone in Congress ever having to vote against Social Security. Very politically dangerous situation. There was enough furor that everyone sort of backed off that, but after Clinton became president, the Bureau of Labor Statistics changed the way they weighted the CPI in a way that they said mimicked the substitution-based concept. And because of that, right now, what is 4.3% inflation would be around 7.5% inflation if they hadn't made that change. Social Security checks would be double what they are today. I mean, that's cumulative over time.
Let me stop you right there, Mr. Williams. Let me just stop you there with that one example, because this is, you know, you're just calmly reporting on this, and that's important. But let's break down the incredible statement you just made. Since what, the mid 1990s, and that's what our other experts have basically been saying. Social Security checks for what we paid in and for the real index should be double what they are. Instead, the checks are going up 2-3% a year, and so they've only gone up maybe 20% instead of double. So you had a massive attack on people that are on fixed incomes and who have paid in to Social Security their entire lives, also people that are disabled, people that are on pensions. This is incredible.
And it goes beyond that to people that have union contracts or wage agreements that are tied to the CPI. It is widespread, and it's one reason that people find, or the average household finds, that they can't make ends meet. That's a common problem.
But the news media, at least until now, would say, "Oh, well, it's a recession if you're out of work. It's a depression if you know everybody's out of work, or it's a recession when your neighbor's out of work, and it's a depression when you're out of work." And they just kept saying in the last few years, "Everything's fine, everything's wonderful." You know, it's a conspiracy theory to say that things are getting more expensive, but now they can't cover it up anymore.
That's right. Indeed, they can't. I mean, even the core inflation is. Mr. Bernanke likes to look at the lowest rate. Even that is starting to move higher, and for good reason. I mean, a lot of the inflation we've seen in the last year or two has been tied to the extraordinary surge in the price of oil. Oil is not just gasoline. The effect of oil prices permeates the economy.
Plastics, shipping, everything.
Yeah, everything, including pharmaceuticals, fertilizers, and indeed the transportation. Anything that gets transported. And that's, they've been very slow picking that up.
Now, of course, most of oil, sir, and tell me if I'm wrong, most of oil's increase, if you're buying in euros, oil hadn't really gone up. But if you're buying in dollars, it has. Isn't it dollar devaluation that has triggered?
It's most sharply in dollars because among other things, dollars are plummeting right now. And as the dollars drop, it becomes cheaper for people let's say, who live denominated in euros or Swiss francs or yen to buy oil in dollars. It's becoming cheaper for them. But that has a counter effect in the marketplace. It's sort of an imbalance. And the effect is it tends to spike oil prices, which we're seeing now. I mean, one reason oil prices are rising is because the dollar is dropping in value. And I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, there have already been rumblings about it, but not too far down the road, you see OPEC abandon the dollar as the method of evaluation. And
well, yes, in the last 12 days, we've seen the dollar's biggest drop in modern history. And I said Monday, when we learned about it last Monday, that it was going to happen. It wasn't hard for me to figure out. And then finally, mainstream news admitted that Greenspan, speaking to a group of Arab oil-producing nations, told them to dump the dollar as the peg. Meanwhile, the government's cutting interest rates, knowing that's going to drive down the dollar further. Why is the Federal Reserve and the people that dominate our economy, why have they made the decision to abandon the dollar?
This goes back to the Nixon administration, as I understand it. Arthur Burns, who was Fed chairman at that time, was a guiding light for people such as Greenspan, and basically gave them advice, which you've seen followed by many others over time. If you run into trouble, abandon the dollar, forget about the budget deficit. Neither of those is ever going to get you votes. And we've seen that happen when the stock market crashed in 87.
Stay there, sir. I want to talk about market fundamentals, how they're manipulating the numbers, and where you forecast this economy is going. We'll be right back with our guest, John Williams, ShadowStats.com.
It's loaded, everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost. Everybody knows.
Okay, I want to talk with our guest more about how they cook the books, but more importantly, we know he's the expert on that. What he forecasts in the future, that talk of inflationary depression, and then how we can pull out of this in his educated opinion. We don't hear any candidate but Ron Paul from Democrats or Republicans talking about the inflation tax, talking about how Social Security recipients in the last 15 years, really 12 years, have had their check really cut in half for purchasing power. You talk about depression. You talk about inflationary depression. Give us your forecast on, will it just be a deep recession? How long, or is it going to turn into an inflationary depression?
Well, we're already in an inflationary recession. And it's just a matter of depth and also level of inflation that makes it hyperinflationary depression. Let me make a couple of points up front. One is to define the depression. You won't find a standard definition around. It used to be that prior to the Great Depression, that every downturn was called a depression. And if you plotted out the level of economic activity, it sort of dipped like a bowl. And after the Great Depression, the idea was to come up with a euphemism for depression, and the down part of the line going into the bowl was called a recession. So they changed the name of a depression to a recession. Some decades back, I talked to a number of people throughout the government and the private sector trying to put this into perspective and how it could be defined. Generally, a recession, despite some protestations to the contrary, that's usually defined as two consecutive quarters of declining growth in the gross domestic product, which is the broadest measure of economic activity adjusted for inflation. A depression would be a decline from the peak of economic activity to the trough of greater than 10%. We haven't had one like that since the Great Depression. And a Great Depression would be a decline of greater than 20% from peak to trough.
That's, how close are we to that?
If you had an accurate measure of the GDP, which we don't, you'd be right now about halfway into a depression. We'd be down about 5%.
Good God, and they say this recession is just starting. On average, the top economists and forecasters we have on say a 3-year recession. If it continues to recess, and like you said, goes down as much as it's already fallen, then that will be a depression. And I would imagine if it's going to be a three-year recession, that's going to be called a deep depression.
Well, how it's going to be called remains to be seen. Those definitions I gave you are mine. There's nothing published out there. Someone will eventually get around to addressing the issue.
So basically, we'll have a depression, and they'll never say we had one. They'll just say it's a recession if it really is a depression.
Yeah, well, that's that we've had recessions that have disappeared, and the government's redefinition. But what you have in play here is a problem that started back in the 1970s. If you go back 30 years and you look at the what the government publishes in terms of average real weekly earnings, that means what the average person earns in a week adjusted for inflation, you're down 20-30% from where you were back in 1970. And the difference that makes is that back in 1970, on average, the husband had worked, the wife had stayed home with the kids. Today, that's not the case. You need at least the husband and wife working, maybe someone else in the family.
Incredible.
And the reason that's happened, more than anything else, has been trade policies, which have been resulted in the loss of our manufacturing base offshore.
I want to get into the causes and then the solutions, but what you're saying is, just as a layman, what I've observed, true standard of living for 30 years has been dropping for the average family, for the average individual. So
yes,
really, we've been in one long recession, now culminating in what could be an economic collapse.
Yeah, that's about it. It's a structural change. If you can't turn it around with some finagling with interest rates by the Fed, it's protracted. It's very deep. We're in it. It's going to become a depression. I think it's going to become a Great Depression. But unlike the Great Depression back in the 30s, where you had a severe deflation, prices dropped, here we're going to have inflation. We already have inflation, but it's going to become a hyperinflation. And my definition of a hyperinflation, this is not next week. This is down the road a year or two.
Got to break again. I got to hear this on the other side. Quick break. Back with our guest. We'll take a few calls for him. If you have quick questions, at 1-800-259-9231. Only on the subject of the economy.
Waging war on corruption. Alex Jones on the GCM Radio Network.
Final segment with our guest. A lot of the stuff on the site is free. He also has a subscription there that I suggest you get. If you have any brain in your head, he consults for some of the biggest Fortune 500 companies who want real numbers, real stats, shadowstats.com. Being ignorant is a good way to lose everything you got, folks. We know how these people operate, and we're sitting pretty here. What about you? All right, the country is basically on the rocks. I don't want to ask our guest how we get out of that, in his opinion, or there is a way. But he was just now saying that we've been in a recessionary slide since the 70s, but now there's a systematic change in the whole system coming to a head, he said, in the next year or two. That fits with Stiglitz, that fits with people from totally different economic views and camps, that fits with Roberts, it fits with everybody else. We've literally hundreds of economists we've had on, but you rarely hear it on the news, and now they're finally starting to admit it. Is that because the establishment media has tried to cover this up so long that now they just look stupid covering it up, Mr. Williams, and they're having to admit it?
I think the establishment media pretty much follows what they hear from Wall Street. That tends to be the common source of information, and you'll never get a naked view on the economy or what's happening from Wall Street. I can't say never. I mean, there are a couple of people that will give you a straight view, but generally Wall Street has to sell product, and they're not going to put out information that kills your business.
Okay, let's move quick. Let's go back to where we were before the break. You said a hyperinflation, deep depression within the next 2 years is what you see.
I see the
possibility.
Let me just clarify that. We are now in an inflationary recession. I mean, you've got inflation on the rise. You've got the economy in a tumble. I mean, there's a sharp drop in employment that was reported today. all sorts of indicators that that is happening right now. I'm looking for the downturn in the economy to deepen to actually become a depression. And on the inflation front, inflation, and it's from the inflation standpoint turning to hyperinflation, that I'm talking 2 years, maybe more, plus or minus. This is the ultimate disaster that unfolds, but I don't see any way out of it, and I'll explain why. When I talk about hyperinflation, I'm talking about an inflation so powerful that that the dollar effectively becomes worthless. You can take a $100 bill, and it'll be worth more as a functional piece of toilet paper than it will be as currency. That's my definition of a hyperinflation.
To the price of toilet paper.
It'll be worth more as toilet paper than as a $100 bill.
Good God.
That's how bad it gets. Now,
Weimar Republic level inflation.
Exactly. And this has been set up over the decades by both Republican and Democrat administrations. There's no one culpable party here. They're all involved in it. And the issue, it's interesting how these things work out, but right now the government is required by law to publish financial statements as though it were a corporation, using generally accepted accounting principles. And when you do that, and you look at them carefully, what they're telling you is that the deficit isn't $200 billion or $300 billion or $160 billion. It's around $4 trillion. The reason for that is the amount of what they call unfunded liabilities that are being taken on year after year with Social Security and Medicare. And putting that $4 trillion number in perspective, and I meant that's the shortfall in 1 year. That's what we're losing each year. If you wanted to reverse that, let's say you wanted to balance the real budget, you could raise taxes to take 100% of wages, salaries, corporate profits, and the government still would be in deficit.
I remember 10 years ago seeing Wall Street Journal articles about that current expenditures, they talked about by 2010, 83% of your paycheck for taxes. Now you're saying 10 years later we've reached a point where it cannot be paid back, a black hole of debt.
That is correct. Now, the other side of it, of course, is cutting the spending, but that would mean slashing Social Security and Medicare, and you have nobody in Washington who's willing even to consider discussing that.
Has already destroyed half the value of that Social Security check.
Yeah. Yes, well, it's going to destroy the rest of it because nobody in Washington has the guts to face the problem. And the way the politicians usually handle it, and there have been similar circumstances, never this bad of the scope with the world's reserve currency, but there have been similar circumstances in the past. And the way the nations usually resolve it, they don't default on their debt, they just drive up the printing presses.
They inflate.
And they inflate and they pay people off with worthless money.
And it's clear
they're money, but it's not worth anything.
And now the world is holding hundreds of trillions of dollars of debt and dollars and the rest of it. How do you see that unraveling? I mean, give us a forecast of how it could.
Well, but we're beginning to see that unravel. That's what's frightening, because the aside from our wonderful trade policies, we've pushed so much of the productive capacity offshore. We're running a terrible annual trade deficit, which is pumping excess dollars into the global system, and we have a lot of people outside the United States who, rather than throw it back at us and say, "Hey, we want to redeem it," and actually, you can't redeem it against gold, but the effect would, if everyone cashed in, you'd see a sharp decline in the dollar. They come back and they buy treasury bills and bonds and other financial instruments, and the amount of money here has been so significant that it has done a lot to provide liquidity to our system. If you go back over the last several years and you take the net debt issuance by the U.S. government, that's been covered almost 100% by the influx of investment from people holding otherwise unwanted dollars. Now, as long as the dollar is holding its value, you know, maybe they're going to come out okay on it. But now we're seeing the dollar drop very sharply.
Sir, that brings me to the $64 million question. Why is the Federal Reserve bad-mouthing? Why is Greenspan bad-mouthing the dollar? Why, if all we've got left is even the fiat perceived confidence in the dollar, and they're doing everything they can to badmouth it while putting all their money in euros and pound and yen. I read the Financial Times of London 6 months ago saying big central banks actually want to implode our economy to consolidate it. But then I talked to other economists that say this is going to pull down the entire world market. So is there a method to the madness? Is this a predatory, engineered implosion? Or are they rationalizing, saying they're going to come out on top? What I'm getting at here is, they admit in the news they're building internment camps. I don't know if you've seen that in major papers, San Francisco Chronicle, Houston Chronicle. They are militarizing police. They are giving them microwave cannons mounted on top of Humvees. The John Warner Defense Authorization Act says they're getting ready for martial law. Does that tie into this?
That's an area I can't give you a good answer to. I've heard those stories. But I can tell you that I think in terms of what's happening here and what we're seeing right now...
You're just covering the economic outlook, yeah.
It's been more gross incompetence and overconfidence, belief that the computer models could resolve everything, that they could control the system. And from the politician standpoint, not planning beyond the next election, buying votes in the near term. I mean, it's a system that's been running out of control.
Short-term thoughts, greed.
I'm sorry?
Short-term
thoughts. I'm a little hard of hearing.
I'm sorry, short-term thought.
Short-term thoughts in terms of what's happening?
Well, I mean, they're doing everything according to a short-term.
In other words, corporate America is not too much better. It operates on a looking one quarter ahead. The government, they'll look at as far as the next election, which... is never more than 2 years off.
Okay, physically, what will it look like if we go into this inflationary depression? What will it look like on the streets of Main, Main Street, USA?
It's going to be very painful and very scary. I can give you an idea in terms of what's going to happen with economics, but when you get into the nitty gritty of what this does to people. It's anyone's guess as to how far certain things go. I can tell you that from a political standpoint, the most powerful motivation for voting is a person's pocketbook. That's determined more elections than anything else. The pocketbook issues here are going to be so severe by the next presidential election, barring revolution in the streets, I would expect a significant shift in power, and it'd be a good opportunity for a third party to make an option.
I was about to say.
I think the Republicans or the Democrats. But
I was about to say, sir, I just brought up revolution and the government's response, then you bring up revolution. That's the big question is...
It could happen. I don't know. It's the type of thing that people are going to be uncomfortable enough and will be in enough financial pain. You'll probably see disruption to the normal flow of goods and commerce. And that's the type of thing that does lead to civil unrest. But how something like that works out,
who knows?
I'm not an expert on.
Well, we had Lou Dobbs on yesterday for 20 minutes, and he said he sees a confrontation, whether it's physical or whatever it's going to be, because the Democrats are offering even bigger government and socialized health care when we're already bankrupt. The Republicans...
Absolutely. There's really no chance that I see with either of the current parties of addressing what is now clearly a problem that, without question, it, within a limited period of time, will bring the system as we know it to an end.
Okay, so on the outside,
you're talking
4 years...
the world reserve currency becoming worthless. And in terms of global scope, and you talk about conspiracy theories and such, and this is one area where, to me, I think this would not make sense. And that is that if the dollar becomes worthless... Again, that's the biggest portion of the currency markets, the global economy. But the whole globe is going to be in turmoil. The financial markets globally will be in turmoil. The currency system will have to be revamped. And you'll end up with a new currency system. I don't know. And I'm talking a global currency system.
See.
And how that ends up, I don't know. But I can tell you, if they're going to try and sell it to the public, it's likely going to have some gold in it somewhere.
Did you see the report a month ago by the Council on Foreign Relations, released by their full committee on economics, calling for a global currency to answer the dollar crisis?
No, I didn't see that. I certainly wouldn't advocate a global currency. You've got all sorts of problems with that.
But you see them now.
I know there are people who would like to see world evolve into one government, but I'll contend that if you look at what's happened around the globe, that the movement of people and what people are looking for, it seems to be more in the other direction.
Okay.
With a dissolution and breakup of states.
Sir, we only have about 5 minutes left, and I want to jam in three calls. But my last question for John Williams at ShadowStats.com, then jam these calls in with quick questions, quick answers, is this. You said in that CNN piece, I would get into cash and a little bit of gold. But if cash is going down to toilet paper value, why wouldn't you fully get in to a portfolio of different metals? I'm confused.
Yeah, well, I'm not an investment advisor. I'm an economist. I'm talking in real broad terms here. This is an environment where the investor wants to protect his wealth, his assets, and as a result, what you invest in, you want it to be safe and liquid. I mean, those would be two pre-qualifications.
But you're not going to tell people to get into gold because that's not what you do. But you did say,
gold is a very fine hedge and investment in that area.
What else is?
I would also like to look to have some assets outside the dollar.
I agree.
In the time we have to get people who said, oh, I want to move my assets outside the dollar, I can't tell them how to do that. They have to talk with their own
very complex
investment professionals as to how to accomplish that, to express their concerns. Say, hey, I don't like to be in the dollar. Get me some investments outside
Swiss
the dollar.
Swiss bonds.
That would accomplish it, but I'm
one small part.
Generally, I think interest rates are going to rise globally, so you want to stay short term in terms of debt and instruments.
I agree.
High quality, safety, liquidity. Those are the general guidelines you want to look at.
Portability, mobility. Dave in Illinois, you're on the air with one of the global leading experts on forecasting, ShadowStats.com. John Williams, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Alex. My question is, Roosevelt had the New Deal that pulled us out of the 1929 Depression, which created jobs, and they had the CC camps. What do you see about after, there's no doubt this is all going to collapse. It's coming. I've been seeing it, being in the transportation business since 2004, in the fall whenever it started falling. And what's your feelings and thoughts about how we're going to get out of it once it does fall? Even if they make, new money, you're still going to have some kind of employment for people to make this new money for them to spend it. Or are we going to live in a road warrior type atmosphere? This is really concerns me. And how about all the trillions that, for instance, we owe China? Are they going to take, possession of our ground, or are they?
They're already taking assets. That's what the foreigners are doing. Thank you, Dave. Incredible question, Mr. Williams.
Well, in terms of the trillions of dollars that are out there, where the government owes the money, they're going to pay it off with worthless money, and so that's taken care of. In terms of how you get out of it or where you go, again, I can't tell you what the political environment is going to evolve into here, but if the system were left to its own devices and you didn't have a government intervention and you didn't have all these destructive trade policies, the system would become self-righting. We didn't get into this overnight. We're not going to get out of it overnight. It could be a couple of decades until things started to return to a normal basis.
We're up the creek without a paddle.
I'm sorry?
We're up the creek without a paddle.
We are, but there have been so many excesses in the system. I mean, people talk in fear and terror of a recession. Recession's a normal part of the business cycle. It's like going to sleep at night. It cleanses your system. They've done everything they can to prevent it, and there's so much waste and trouble in the system. The plus in all this is that all the bad stuff should get flushed out of the system. Now, maybe the politics will go bad in the other way, and counterbalance that, the system by itself will tend to become self-righting.
Well, Mr. Williams, that's my fear, is that they know this is coming, and they're going to gear up and bring us into tyranny and use the crisis to bring us into something even worse.
Well, I sure hope you're wrong on that.
Okay, sir.
But I can tell you that the financial circumstance will be severe enough that almost anything could happen there.
Mr. Williams, hold on one moment. I'd like to talk to you during the break and say bye to you, or maybe twist the arm for two more minutes on the other side and take two more calls. We'll be right back. We'll see what happens. Our guest stayed with us into this final segment. He's very busy. He's agreed to pop in next week with a couple segments on solutions and ideas he's got to get us out of this. But we held him over so you could take two final calls. Mark and Terry, sorry about the others. We'll take yours next hour. Mark in Atlanta, Georgia, you're on the air with our guest, the head of ShadowScouts.com.
Blessings to you. I've been long-term unemployed thanks to the New World Order. And one, I'm planning on getting a victory garden going as the season progresses, as well as being on good terms with an organic farm just a little bit down the road from my dad's place out in the country. I was wondering if there's any particular industries that might, like, would mining be a good industry to get into, given that the value of precious metals will be shooting up? For example, would that be a good place to go?
Mining industry and stocks, the whole thing's up. But again, if everything craters, you can't guarantee that. Medical, nursing, government, but then that's, let's talk to the experts, sir.
Well, I don't know if I'm an expert there. I would look for, people will need to eat, and farming is a wonderful area. The problem with mining and such is, you're in Georgia?
There's Dahlonega, which had a gold mine going back to the 19th century.
Well, I mean, gold prices get high enough that it's economic, that might be a good idea. I mean, it all depends on the circumstance. But
sir, they tend to hire people who've been in the industry. I mean, a lot of times it's a bunch of Dutch and Germans at these mines, right, in Arizona or Texas. Listen, got to jump. Thanks for the call. Terry in Seattle, Washington, you're on the air with our guest.
Mr. Williams, it would seem that the implosion of the dollar and our economy is dovetailing perfectly with the establishment of the North American Union and the changing of our currencies to the Amero. I would like to know if you've done any study on the ratio of exchange rates or what history shows us that our rulers do when they decide to do what they're doing to us right now. How are we going to fare, if you don't mind postulating, on how many Ameros we're going to get for the dollar? Do you have any idea?
Well, I think this is the question. We already know it's 154 to the dollar right now. The pound's even more. It's $2.02 against the dollar. Here's the big question. How fast do you project the dollar's going to devalue down to toilet paper?
Well, that's my two years plus forecast. It's gonna take a little time till all the pressures for the hyperinflation kick in. The Fed's doing a lot to move it along right now. It still could be some years down the road, but in terms of constructing an Amero with a dollar that's worthless, that becomes an interesting task.
Well, that's what they want to do. They've said it. But here's the last question. Do you see an incremental slow slide at an angle, down at a 45-degree angle, or do you see it in steps down, or do you see it as just a plunge?
Well, odds would favor things happening a lot faster than most people would think, and it can happen very quickly, so it'd be more of a plunge. Would be my betting.
So odds are 2 years out.
Possible.
But odds are 2 years out for total bedlam, but you're saying it could happen next week.
It could. I think it's a little further down the road, but when it hits, it should hit hard and fast.
Oh, my gosh. So kind of a slow slide and suddenly a plunge.
Yeah, something along those lines. And that would be my guess. Again, almost anything can happen here. We're, despite other countries having gone through similar things, no one's gone through exactly the type of thing we're going through. Here, we're very much in uncharted waters.
And in the Great Depression, we were 80% agrarian. Now we're 90%+ city. Unbelievable. ShadowStats.com, John Williams, thank you for your analysis and time.
Most welcome.
We'll be right back. We just tell the truth. It isn't hard to figure this stuff out. Ted Anderson was talking to his brokers last night, and they were like, yeah, well, you know, when do you think the dollar will come back, Ted? And Ted said, it ain't ever coming back. It's about a 95% chance. We're going into total world government. They're going to use this as a police state crackdown. We're not giving you negative news, okay? We're just telling you the truth. It isn't negative to tell you the truth. It's very positive what you're hearing here. Horrible, deep recession that they call a recession. It's really a depression. And he said guaranteed depression. I hope that's not the case, but I know this. Gold and silver are only going to go up in the long term, even the short term. It's up today, you know, we're staying right at 980. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. We're getting into 9/11, a bunch of other police state news in the next segment. But Ted has got the same price he had a week ago. It's going to be going up if gold doesn't go down, and it isn't going down. It's going up. And he's about to run out of this. They're going to have brokers there all weekend, Saturday and Sunday, and late tonight to take your orders. Ted, tell them about the offer. They just heard the economic outlook. I was just telling Ted the tiny amount of money he makes doing this, and how it supports the network, because there's literally about a 4% markup here just to take the orders. I guess about the same in the silver. And I said, we are capitalizing the network in a small way, and we're doing it completely morally. That's how I roll, ladies and gentlemen. You need to call and melt their phones down. I don't care if it's one quarter gold piece or 20 ounces of gold. Folks, we told you to buy it when it was 260-something. Now it's 980. And, folks, you just heard it. The globalists are shutting this country down. We can't probably save the country in the short term, but we can maybe.
Hi, I'm Chuck Missler, and I'm glad to be with you once again. We published a series of briefings called the Vortex Strategy a decade and a half ago, partly motivated by my personal background from the intelligence community and also my time on Wall Street. It was a focus of our ministry very early. And in view of the uncertain times that we seem to be heading into, we felt it would be appropriate to review some of these ideas again, which we call the Vortex Strategy. And this first session will focus primarily on the predicament that you and I appear to be facing. And there's great uncertainty on Wall Street. Are we going for hyperinflation, deflation? There's instability in our political world. There's instability in our financial world. And all of this puts pressures on us as individuals and heads of family as to what to do about it. So we're going to focus into this. So let's start, though, with a focus on our situation right here in America this year. Our stock indexes are at unprecedented highs. As we check today, it's higher than ever. So it must be a wonderful time. The people are buying their third and fourth cars. Almost every home has a computer. It's hard to find anyone without a phone growing out of his ear. Fuel costs less than the water we drink. So in the minds of many, it's the best of times. But not so to those that are spiritually sensitive. In elementary and secondary education, we're near the bottom of the achievement scores worldwide. There's a coarseness, a callousness, a cynicism, banality and vulgarity signaling the decivilization of our nation. It appears ready to happen. All but one of the allies, they're detailed, are in place. The one that's missing is Turkey. So watch Turkey as it swings from over 80 years of trying to be part of the West to swinging back to an Eastern orientation and participating in this. Meanwhile, Russia is moving its Black Sea fleet from Odessa into the Eastern Mediterranean. And furthermore, Iran is installing its medium-range ballistic missiles, the Saab 3s, in the Syrian highlands, and Russia is surrounding them with their highly venerated air defense. And while all that's going on, we're dispatching the third carrier to the Fifth Fleet into the Gulf region, the USS Enterprise, the first nuclear-powered carrier, is joining the two that are already there. Let's talk about nuclear materials. There's plenty of money. See, we understand that bin Laden has no shortage of cash. In fact, George Tenet, former director of the CIA, has indicated his opinion that there's little doubt that many nukes are presently already in the United States. And that's obviously a concern to all of us. Now, the Department of Homeland Security has officially declared the following. Americans should prepare for the inevitability of a nuclear event sometime in the future. So it's a question of when, not if. Well, in this spirit, though, I have to throw in one little quote that I get a big kick out of by none other than Jay Leno. He had on one of his shows, he had a great line. He says, with hurricanes, tornadoes, fires out of control, mudslides, flooding, severe thunderstorms tearing up the country from one end to another, and with a threat of the bird flu and terrorist attacks, are we sure this is a good time to take God out of the Pledge of Allegiance? Well said. Well, let's move on. The third scenario is the one that concerns me personally the most. Well, in this sense, there is a technology that I think is important for every one of us that take our families seriously to understand. It's called electromagnetic pulse. EMP is the abbreviation. It's a two word. Electromagnetic is one word, but you can't explain engineers. It's a three-letter abbreviation, EMP. Back in 1962 in the Pacific atomic tests, there was a series called Starfish. They launched one 400 kilometers over Johnston Island, 1.4 megaton warhead, virtually almost 1,000 miles away in Hawaii. Street lights were blown out, alarms tripped, damaged telecommunication facilities. That's where they began to discover that one of the side effects of a very high-altitude nuclear blast is an extremely intense magnetic pulse, a damaging pulse. It disrupted navigation in Australia for 18 hours. The Soviets, in their tests, learned the same thing. They even had buried power cables that were burned out from these tests. That's what led to the United States and the Soviet Union to enter into a treaty of no more high-altitude bursts, because they realized that it creates unforeseen damage. Still, that's when they went to all the underground testing, that sort of thing. But what you need to understand, there is a report that was impaneled by the Congress. They created a commission specifically to assess the threat to the United States from an electromagnetic pulse attack. This commission published its report in July of 2004, and it's available today on the Internet. You can read it. If you launch a nuclear weapon at 100 miles or more above the center of the United States, that magnetic pulse that it creates is line of sight in all directions, and it would reach virtually coast to coast, frying the circuits connected to any long wire. Not just disabling for a while, destroying them. And so, the vulnerability, we've always known that Israel is a one-bomb country. One nuke over Tel Aviv, and that story is over, it would seem. The shock of this commission was to realize that the United States is a one-bomb country, not in terms of direct damage, but in terms of plunging it back to the 19th century. Just one bomb delivered at a high altitude could plunge the United States back into the 19th century. It would destroy telecommunications, not just for a few hours, permanently. It would thus destroy power, and not just for a few hours. Imagine the major cities without power. How do you send an ambulance downtown if there's gridlock because the signals aren't working? At Katrina, we discovered you can't pump gas out of a gas station if there's no power to pump it. Visualize our major cities with no water, no food, no sanitation, and by the way, no law enforcement. The other insight of the commission was that once something like this happens, there's no way to install a recovery plan. Whatever recovery plan you may conjure up has to be installed before it happens, because the very effect of it would eliminate your ability to do that. Well, by the way, let me give you a small modification of this. You don't have to get that nuke over the center of the United States. Visualize an unmarked container ship that is approaching the U.S. coast, and it doesn't have to get closer than a few hundred miles before, from that container ship, you launch a Sahab 3, a standard off-the-shelf Sahab 3, that could easily get to Cincinnati or Indianapolis. You don't care about accuracy, you care about altitude. And once you launch it, you don't cover the whole United States. But if you look at the United States, this map at night, you'll get the idea you would cover about 70% of the population, one bomb. That population would be plunged back to 19th century technologies, and it would take the United States out of the game as a major player, because you're destroying the electronics in Washington, D.C., in New York, Boston, you make the list. Let's talk about something even closer to home, the impending monetary crisis here in America. The U.S. dollar, two-thirds of world trade is conducted at the moment in dollars. Over 70% of the central bank's currency reserves throughout the world are held in U.S. dollars. It's the sole currency used by the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, and so on. This has conferred on the United States an economic advantage. It means that we have the ability to run a trade deficit each year because people are willing to lend us dollars. And the reason they do that is because dollars, foreign countries need dollars to repay their debts to the IMF, to conduct international trade, and to build up their own currency reserves. That's the status so far. A move away from the dollar towards, say, the euro or any one of the other currencies could have a disaster effect on the U.S. economy, as the U.S. would no longer be able to spend beyond its means. The U.S. would then be forced to become a net currency importer, as foreigners would seek to spend their dollars in the U.S., and that's a large portion of the $3 trillion that they currently carry. Furthermore, the U.S. would be forced to have a trade surplus. That would be if we had one, it would be the first time in over 100 years, providing more goods and services than we get in return. So a rapid and wholesale move, say to the euro or one of the other currencies, could lead to a dollar crash as everyone tried to get rid of some or all of their U.S. dollars at the same time. Now, fortunately, that's not the outcome that either Europe, Russia, or China are seeking, because they all have so many dollar assets, they would hope that the crash would be a soft landing. Except my experience with traders on the street, once they see a need, there's a race for the exits. So we'll see. The soft landing would not be in anyone's interest, except perhaps Islam's. So we should keep an eye on that one. How does it all come about? Well, the oil exporters, we see when up till about 1950, we were a major oil exporter. That all changed as we started to consume more than we produced. Sales of oil and natural gas up till then had been exclusively denominated in dollars, because we accounted for more than half of the annual oil production. But the tendency to price in dollars was additionally reinforced by a conference in 1944 called Bretton Woods, which established the dollar both for the IMF and the World Bank and so on. 1944, 44 countries created the International Monetary Fund. They also established what we call the gold exchange standard, that banks could exchange their dollars for gold. And on that basis, they all agreed to lock their currencies to the U.S. dollar. That all sounded pretty good until about 1971, when Nixon realized that there was five times as many claims on dollars in gold as there was gold in Fort Knox. So he did the only thing he could do. He shut the gold window. He simply abrogated that commitment in August of 1971. At this point, all the bankers in the world were stuck. What are you going to do, go to war with the United States? No. They had to swallow hard, but now their dollars were only as good, but they were backed by only the reputation of the U.S. government, nothing tangible. So there's a quiet game going on, because while the denomination of oil sales is not a subject that is normal conversation in most family circles, it is well understood by governments and large corporations. In 1971, when Nixon took the U.S. off the gold standard, OPEC considered shifting its contracts into euros. But what we did is we did a deal with Saudi Arabia in the hopes that if we could lock them up, that everybody else would follow. We guaranteed Saudi Arabia's defense in exchange for keeping the dollar the form of denomination. And that's exactly what they called in Desert Storm when we had the Kuwait thing took place. It was basically making good that treaty arrangement. So what the Saudis did, of course, OPEC followed. Now, the think tanks are warning us. Countries switching to euro reserves and dollar reserves will bring down the value of the U.S. currency. Imports would start to cost Americans a lot more. As countries and businesses convert their dollar assets into euro assets, the U.S. property and stock market bubbles would, without a doubt, burst. And that's just typical of many of the think tanks that are tracking this possibility. Now, what's interesting China is doing perhaps the most interesting thing. See, the dollar's position is already on decline in many countries. That's the opinion of the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco. China's doing something interesting. They are building gigantic storage tanks, and they're starting to put their reserves not into anyone's currency, but into black gold, as some people call it, oil. They're diversifying their foreign exchange holdings into oil. These tanks have another year or two to go before they're completed. But it's already starting. On January of this year, Kuwait announced that they're considering abandoning pegging its dinar to the dollar for fear of anticipated slide in the value of the dollar. Everybody's starting to recognize the dollar is shaky. The central banks of Italy, Russia, Sweden, and United Arab Emirates have announced similar shifts out of the dollar into other currencies or gold, citing the United States' twin deficits, and I'll come to that in a minute, and as the reason for the fallen value of the dollar. Bush and the current Congress, get this now, have authorized and borrowed more money from foreign governments, banks and other companies and citizens, than all of the previous 42 U.S. administrations combined. Add up all the borrowings before they took up offering in the history of this country, and they borrowed more. See, from 1776 to the year 2000, the first 224 years of our history, 42 presidents borrowed a combined $1.01 trillion from foreign governments and financial institutions. That's according to the Treasury Department. In the last 4 years alone, the Bush administration has borrowed $1.05, slightly more than all that put together. But let's talk about something else. Let's talk about trade balance. We buy more than we sell. We always have. We finance our purchases with debt currency. Our current imbalance in the deficit is over $850 billion per year. It's a big number. Let's take a look at this. When we first started publishing our Vortex strategy materials in the early 90s, we were facing about a $100 billion negative trade balance and thought that was something to be concerned over. And as the years went on, it started to get really worse by a factor of 4 to 1, started to improve a little bit in the year 2000-2001, but guess what happened subsequently? It grows and grows. It is now 8 times what it was when we were concerned back in the early 90s. And last year, $850 billion. Almost $1 trillion a year. Now, let's talk a different thing. Let's talk about the government itself, its debt. The Bush administration is forecasting that the federal deficit for 2007 budget year will be $244 billion. That's a little better than it was last year, if they make it, but they probably won't. So as we look, since the government spends more than it takes in revenue, they finance their operations with debt. So let's take a look at the dilemma of the U.S. Treasury today. The federal deficit is about $250 billion, let's round it off, $250 billion a year. The trade deficit internationally is $850 billion a day. That means we have a deficit requirement. We need to borrow $1.1 trillion per year. That's $3 billion per day. Per day. I'm going to be very interested to see who's willing to pick up those notes as time goes on here. Let's talk about the consumer. Let's just take one thing, mortgage debt. It startled me to realize that the mortgage debt has also been growing to where it approximates the federal debt. Can you imagine? Growing, growing, growing. No savings rate in this country. Everybody thinks their savings is the equity of their homes, not realizing that that's a derived number. Let's talk about foreclosures. They're starting to escalate. Major concern within the boardrooms of America is whether this factor is going to cloud everything else going on. Home foreclosures are mounting. The mortgage companies are knocking on doors, sending letters, making phone calls, trying to help the struggling homeowners. They'd rather modify the loan than foreclose. Critics say the lenders are making loans to borrowers who aren't creditworthy with terms that would be impossible for them to meet. Where the current wave of workouts is merely postponing foreclosures, we'll see. I got the strangest letter from my own bank just a couple days ago. I have a Visa card with my bank. The letter says, by the way, Chuck, anything that you buy in the next few months will carry zero interest all the way to the end of the year. And I'm looking at this puzzled. If they were soliciting new business, like take our credit card and we'll do this for you. I can understand there's a promotional letter. I get three or four of those, you know, a day from various credit card companies. This is from my own bank with a card that I already have. Why are they willing to run my interest to zero? See, I close it. I don't allow it to grow. I keep it current for reasons I'll explain in a minute. But I was puzzled. The more I thought about the letter, the more it puzzled me. There's no business reason for them to want to do that, because they're not getting anything by my doing that. They're giving away interest that I would normally charge. They'll be charged. Unless something behind the scenes, like the government, is finding a way for the bankers to keep the spending up by everybody. They're doing everything they can to prop up our economy between now and the election. And the banks are the front line of that, apparently. Let's talk about money supply. Money is the quantity of money within the economy to purchase things, services, and so forth. The money supply affects the interest rates inversely. The more money supply increases, the interest rates fall. And when the interest rates equates, then the money demanded with the quantity of supply, the economy is working at the what's called money market equilibrium. Understand there's an economy and there's a monetary system. They aren't always in balance. But when they are in balance, then, okay, that's the way it works. Now, to measure money supply, there's a number of components. M0 is all the physical currency that we're familiar with. What's called M1, you add to that the demand accounts, like your checking accounts and so forth. Add all that up in the country, and that gives you the M1. You add to that the savings account and certificate CDs and that sort of thing. You finally get to M3, and that's when you take all that plus your, repurchase agreements. And it's the broadest measure of money supply. And it's the primary yardstick of economists to understand what's going on, okay? The M3. Just remember that number. Here is the money supply components, M1, M2, M3. But you'll notice something kind of interesting. That effective in March of 2005, the Federal Reserve has decided that they're not going to publish the M3 anymore. Now, that they have the silly reasons for claiming they're not doing it. They're just deciding not to make manifest their report card. Imagine if I was the chairman of a major public company and I announced to the shareholders, by the way, guys, you're not going to get an annual report this year. There'd be an uproar. That's expected. That's the accountability. Federal Reserve's decided not to let you know how well they're doing at pumping the well. During the 18 years that Greenspan was the head of Federal Reserve, our dollar fell in half. 18 years, it grew to 50% of value. With Bernanke in place, it's destined for lots of reasons to fall a lot further. There will be inflation, whether they'll admit it or not. And this is one way of hiding it for as long as they can. There are other indicators. See, it's not publishing the M3. And your personal stewardship for your families really require you to maintain surveillance of what is going on vis-a-vis the possibility of inflation ahead. Lots of denials in the press. You read these inane panelists on TV, and it's clear they don't get it. But you need to get it. You need to understand what's coming to position yourself. One of the fears is hyperinflation. What do we mean by that? Well, let's take Germany 1920. Food prices doubled every 49 hours. My grandparents sold their restaurant to retire. When they entered escrow, the value of that restaurant was enough for them to retire on. When the escrow closed, what they got was enough to buy a loaf of bread. See, in 1920, a loaf of bread cost 1 mark. By 1923, it cost 726 million marks in 3 years. You and I have no capacity to imagine the trauma of that kind of hyperinflation. In Russia in the 1990s, similar kind of thing. 1994, 100 rubles to the dollar. 1990, within 5 years, 30,000 rubles to the dollar. You can understand the disruption that causes in the economy. It destroys the economy. In the United States, we are now the largest debtor in the world. And our interest rates are not going to go down. They're going to go up. There are presently $48 trillion in debt instruments floating around. People are talking about the end of money. The money supply in 354 years of the history of this country, even before it was a country, the total money supply for 354 years was less than $1 trillion total. In 2006, in 10 months, we needed an extra trillion. We didn't need as much additional currency as we need in the previous three centuries. Total credit market debt in 1975 was about $5 trillion. From 2004 to 2006, just in those 2 years, it increased by that much, $5 trillion. It now totals over $51 trillion in total. These are numbers so large, they're hard to embrace. Household debt has doubled in the past 6 years. Now, to give you what's disturbing about all these trends is that the slope itself is increasing. The rate of increase is increasing. That's called exponentiation. It isn't long before it goes totally unstable. But there's something else that is not being tracked that I want to call to your attention. An unseen leverage. They're called derivatives is the general term for it. They're hidden behind the scenes. What is a derivative? Well, it's an investment that derives its value from something else, from some underlying instrument. In other words, you have an instrument that its value depends on some other instrument. How? By an option, a warrant, futures. Those are all derivative investments. Also convertibles, things that can convert to a derivative are derivatives. Now, the widespread use of derivatives throughout the world have multiplied the risks in the financial markets. The U.S. derivative market today is 8 times larger than the entire economy. The gross domestic product of the United States, multiply that by 8, and you've got an approximation of the derivative market. In 1995, commercial banks alone had $17.5 trillion in derivatives. By 2004, it had escalated from $17.5 to $75.5 trillion, a 235% increase in 10 years. Say, gee, that's 23% a year. No, it's actually worse than that because the percent per year is increasing. It's between 20 and 30% per year growing. Now, what's disturbing about this whole world is 90% of these are traded over the counter with no records. You can only guess and make estimates because it's an unregulated market. It's over the counter. Not all of them, 90%. 10 of them, 10% are regulated, but 90% are not. The total guess at the market is over $400 trillion. 10 times the total indebtedness of the U.S. government. Now, banks are the most fearful, or I should say fearsome, users of these. In 2004, there's about $39 trillion. That's 4 times the U.S. gross domestic product. There's about $11.5 trillion here in the estimates. In 1 year, it went from 39.6 to 76.5, held by banks. Now, what the controller of the currency of the United States points out to us, that of those banks, that the 76.5 trillion derivatives was backed only by 715 billion in equity. In other words, less than 1% is backed hard. That's all leverage. That is unbelievable leverage to be able to put down 0.9% of the risk to get the gain. 7 banks hold 90% of the derivative holdings: J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Citibank. The three of them hold about 3 times the GDP. And when these banks merge, it increases the risks, by the way. That's something that's causing a lot of concern. Let's just take one example. A long-term capital management is a name you probably have not heard unless you follow financial play. It's a company that employs maybe a couple hundred employees. In 1998, this hedge fund called LTCM had $100 billion in assets, $4 billion in cash. It used that as collateral for $1.2 trillion in derivatives. Well, among those derivatives were some Russian bonds. When they collapsed, they were in trouble. They were in such trouble. Here's the interesting part. The Federal Reserve panicked and had to intervene to avoid what they felt would be a complete meltdown of the whole U.S. financial system. One company, a company you've never heard of, that employs about 200 people, could bring down the whole U.S. financial structure? You got to be kidding. No, that was the assessment of the Federal Reserve. They actually connived to get this thing fixed off the table, so to speak. And we could go on with lists of companies, Enron, WorldCom, these huge corporate failures. The root problem was the derivatives. Well, let's shift and let's hear it from David Walker. This is not a fringe guy. This is not some guy trying to publish a book or a newsletter on the television talk shows. He's the Comptroller General of the United States. He's publicly expressed his professional opinion that the American public needs to tell Washington it's time to steer the nation off the path to financial ruin. Quote, what they don't talk about is the dirty little secret everyone in Washington knows, or at least should. The vast majority of economists and budget analysts agree the ship of state is on a disastrous course and will founder on the reefs of economic disaster if nothing is done to correct it. That's the official word from the guy that knows most about it, David Walker. His basic message is that the United States government conducts business as usual over the next few decades. A national debt that is already $8.5 trillion could reach $46 trillion or more adjusted for inflation. A hole that big could paralyze the U.S. economy. According to some projections, just the interest payments on the debt that big would be as much as all the taxes of the government collects today. Just the interest, not all the other costs. Every year that nothing is done, the problem grows by $2 to $3 trillion per year. Let's take a look at the official report published on December 16th of 2006. It says that the federal budget deficit was $4.6 trillion, not the previously reported $248 billion. Only, you know, what's a thousand difference? The difference is that the typical Treasury Department report of federal deficit is on a cash basis where the tax receipts are applied when received to current liabilities. However, here's the point that's interesting. The financial report of the United States is calculated on a GAAP basis. What's a GAAP basis? That's what's commonly known to your accountants as the generally accepted accounting principles. Any formal report of any kind to shareholders is GAAP. Generally is done a GAAP. If you take the United States reports on a GAAP basis, it gets interesting. That means accruals are made for the current year changes in the net present value of unfunded liabilities in social insurance programs such as Social Security and Medicare. Okay. What does that mean? The report shows that on the GAAP accounted negative net worth, the federal government has increased to $53.1 trillion, while the total federal obligations under GAAP accounting now total $54.6 trillion, taking into account the present value of the future Social Security and Medicare liabilities. Here's the punchline. Put simply, their words, the 2006 financial report of the United States shows that the arguments that the U.S. government is bankrupt have increasing merit. Why was that? U.S. government is bankrupt technically. That's the U.S. government talking, not some critic on the sidelines. Does that bother you? This is from the official financial report by the U.S. Treasury, December 15th, 2006. The U.S. debt debacle, we've just told you half the story. Let's go on a little bit. There's an international competitive aspect that's going to crush us. What about this talk about a North American union? And what's this talk about a new currency called the Amero? It's scheduled by the Council for Foreign Relations, presumably by 2010. What's all that about? You know, in 1770, Sir William Pitt said to Britain's House of Lords, there's something behind the throne greater than the king himself. And from that phrase, that introduced in the English language this strange expression, the power behind the throne. Or another vernacular, things are not what they seem. That the politics you see is theater. The real power is behind the scenes. What does it mean? That a self-appointed elite manipulates and guides the direction of governments today, operating beneath the public radar, constantly reinventing themselves and craftily doing end runs around any legislative and judicial regulations blocking their self-serving goals. Felix Frankfurter, the U.S. Supreme Court Justice, has gone on record. He says the real rulers in Washington are invisible and exercise power from behind the scenes. You ever wondered why it seems to make no difference which political party is in office? Doesn't even make any difference, does it? President Bush signed a formal agreement that will end the United States as we know it. And he took the step without approval from either the U.S. Congress or the people of the United States. It's an absolute contravention of our law, of our Constitution, and every national value, and that has been echoed by many commentators, not the least of which was Lou Dobbs and others. The global elite, through the direct operation of President George Bush and his administration, are creating a North American union that will combine Canada, Mexico, and the United States into a superstate called the North American Union, roughly patterned after the European Union. There is no political or economic mandate for creating the NAU, and unofficial polls of the cross-section Americans indicate that they are overwhelmingly against this end run around national sovereignty. That was in the August Review of November last year. Have you noticed all this talk about the border? The Republicans and Democrats are throwing rocks at each other for everything you can imagine, but no one is really calling it by what's really going on. Associated Press points out that 98% of those arrested between October 1st, 2000 and September 30th, 2000, over a five-year period, were never prosecuted for illegally entering the country. Nearly 5.3 million immigrants were simply escorted back across the Rio Grande and turned loose, and presumably they'll slip back later. The number of immigrants prosecuted annually tripled during the five-year period to 30,000, the most recent figures available, but still represented less than 3% of the 1.17 million arrests made in 2005. The prosecution rate was just under 1%. What's going on here? According to the American Immigration Lawyer Association, the likelihood of an illegal immigrant being prosecuted is, to me, practically zero. There is no intent of the administration to fix this problem because there's a hidden agenda. Let's get back to this North American Union that is unofficially being promoted behind the scenes with cabinet officers participating in committees to make it happen. They talk about the Amero, a new currency, a common currency to replace the U.S. dollar, the Canadian dollar, and the Mexican peso. When you hear these things, as I first heard this some years ago, I dismissed it as, well, that's conspiracy talk, that's just extremists, utopian planners, what have you. No, it's getting more and more serious. Anyone that analyzes this, and by the way, according to the architect for all of this is a guy by the name of Robert Pastor, who's director of the Council of Foreign Relations. He's published books on this. They're following his agenda. They're building the superhighway. All that's in our thing. I can't take all the time to get in here now. Except point out this. In order to get the Amero in, it will take a major economic crisis. It would require massive U.S. debt, unbridled credit expansion, and a prospect of a major property collapse in order to create the crisis that would allow this kind of thing to be introduced. Then it hits you between the eyes. They're going to prop up our economy through the election in 2008, for sure. That's understandable. But according to the CFR experts, their plan to introduce is about 2010. So there's a two-year window that we can expect something interesting to happen. Is it possible that the very crisis required is actually being deliberately designed as we speak? We don't know. The scripture says a prudent man foresees the evil and hideth himself, but the simple pass on and are punished. So the question is, okay, we've talked about a lot of these things. We've just scratched the surface. You can get our total collection of 4 DVDs on this to go all over all this stuff. But the real question it'll beg is, what do we do? Great, Chuck. What's the so what question? What do we do about this? The so what question. You and I can't change the course of history. I'm not suggesting we go to Washington, and I'm not suggesting we shouldn't. Obviously, we should have our voices heard. But I wouldn't bank my personal family's future on our ability to change the course of history. So what do we do? We can exercise prudence in our own personal and family preparations for whatever's coming. What does that mean? See, we don't know whether there's going to be deflation or inflation, uncertainty, and that leads to what we call the vortex strategy. So part two of this briefing will be our action plan in view of these uncertainties. See you in the next session.
Late 90s going to urban warfare drills, getting video from Hebron, Maryland, Swansboro, North Carolina, Oakland, California, South Texas, Kingsville, Texas, Alice, Texas, Corpus Christi, Texas, with Marines, Army, Delta Force, Night Stalkers out of Fort Campbell, training to take over cities, confiscate our guns. I had emergency managers on, like Thomas Sanchez over Kingsville, who they contacted and said, this is for martial law takeover drill of the U.S. I had him on the show. I had the police chief of San Antonio on. They tried to bribe him. This is a huge covert operation going on for decades. I learned it really kicked off in about 1984, part of Rex 84. And we have the Senate hearings, congressional hearings on that now, and I've made 3 films on it. So we know this is real. Now, it's exploded under Bush. We told you a year plus before it broke in national news about the clergy response teams. We got the secret FEMA documents. They told them not to release these to anybody, but the pastors did. where they're training their flocks without telling them they're on government payroll to submit to martial law, go to the FEMA camps, take the inoculations. We had those pastors on, and then it came out in mainstream news later, and we have that newscast. And so when I see stories about InfraGuard and 20-plus thousand executives of companies in, quote, key infrastructure, training and being told they're being trained, you know, shoot to kill when martial law comes, well, that's what we already, I've already seen Marines training with role players saying this is for America. I mean, I have video up. And then the FBI came out and attacked Matt Rothschild, who wrote a great story for The Progressive. And then the headline is, FBI calls InfraGuard story patently false. But then you read the story, they admit it's going on, but just say, well, they're not allowed to shoot to kill. So this is going on. They're taking over your local governments, your local infrastructures. It's happening, and it's very childish, folks. I had another big Rothschild on. He's actually is one of the heirs of the big British dynasty who's pushing global taxes, and I was disagreeing with him, and I was still called an enemy of humanity for having him on disagreeing. Now, this guy's a good guy. The family has thousands of people in it. It's very childish that I have to even address this fact for some of the people out there, but I just wanted to address it before people have fun with this on YouTube and everywhere else. We bring you newsmakers. We bring you guests on both sides of the issue, and it's not fair to demonize Mr. Rothschild. I can't believe I'm even raising this point, but I'm sure you get this a lot, Matt.
I get it a lot. Get it often. No problem.
Okay, good. I'm just addressing that up front. How many people are there in the, that you know of in the Rothschild family?
Oh, I don't know. There's got to be millions, hundreds of thousands. I don't know. I haven't looked at all the family trees and everything, but you know, there are a lot of different groups all around the world with that name, and Lord knows how many of us there are. But if I had a dollar for every time someone asked me if I was one of the real Rothschilds, I'd be a real Rothschild.
I know people don't understand that it's just the German translation from Redshield, isn't it?
Correct.
Yeah. All right. Well, there's a lot of Joneses too. So. Hey, I get asked all the time if I'm Jim Jones, so it's all right. Now, seriously, how did you first learn about InfraGuard? Tell us about some of your scholarly research. You've done a great job. And then now these denials. First, break down what InfraGuard is. This particular executive talking about how they're trained to shoot to kill. I've been sent documents by police that show the same thing, and then now they're counter to all this.
Sure. Well, I think a lot of your listeners aren't going to know what InfraGuard is. I didn't know what it was until I got a tip off from another member of the media who said you should check out this organization, and people can find out about it at InfraGuard.net. I mean, this is a group that the FBI set up, a group of 20, I had said in my article, 23,000 representatives of business. Now it's up to 24,000. They are 86 chapters of InfraGuard around the country. Each chapter has a local business person as president of the chapter and an FBI agent who directs that chapter. And what they are doing on the one hand is that they're feeding information to the FBI, and on the other hand, the FBI is feeding them secret threat information almost on a daily basis that the public doesn't get. In fact, you know, the governor of California at one point had to find out from his brother, who was at Morgan Stanley and a member of InfraGuard, that the bridges in California were under threat. So that's kind of bizarre. But the most bizarre thing is that members of InfraGuard at local meetings run by the FBI and Homeland Security are told that that they have permission in times of an emergency, in times of martial law, which this person told me was going to be when, not if, according to the FBI and Homeland Security, that they have permission to use lethal force to protect their little wing of the infrastructure. And these are business people that are in oil and chemical and utilities and phone and every industry in the country, transportation, agriculture, you name it. And so they are told, according to this whistleblower I talked to, who I met, and he was very nervous to talk to me. He showed me his own InfraGuard card, but he said, you know, they were told, you've got permission to shoot to kill.
Now, here's the problem with all of this. A, the White House, even the press secretary, Fleischer, admitted 2-3 years ago now, right before he stepped down, in a press briefing, they said, why are we seeing all these, orange color code alerts? And he said, well, it's for political aim. I don't know why he admitted it, but White House memos have come out where they put these out anytime a corruption scandal or a bid rigging scandal or some bad news comes out, suddenly Al Qaeda is going to, you know, kill us all. We know that they're using this to scare locals. It's creating kind of little secret police units. Anytime, as a citizen, if you really saw somebody about to blow up your power plant, you do have the right to you know, to stop that criminal activity. If you see somebody trying to rob a bank and they're running out with a bag of money, you're not going to go to jail if you draw down on them with your concealed carry and shoot them. So, but it is the secretiveness to all of this, and then now the denial that makes it even more creepy.
Well, and the denial was that they didn't really flat out deny that the FBI is telling InfraGuard members that they have the right to shoot to kill. This was the exact language the FBI used. InfraGuard members have no extraordinary powers and no greater right to shoot to kill than other civilians.
That's right.
I don't take that as a denial, really.
No, and in fact, they're actually stating the law, but they are making these their own little special toadies. I mean, why doesn't the government tell the general public that, hey, we need you, and you've got a right if you see somebody running around, you know, about to kill people? I mean, obviously, we have that right. It doesn't come from government. It's an organic right that springs from common law.
Well, you know, it disturbs me that the government is creating this kind of superior class of people, this business class of people who get all this information on threats before we get it.
Well, that's fascism. Hitler did that.
Yeah, and they are, you know, and they are empowering these people or winking at them to use lethal force in times of emergency. I mean, and to what extent are those people going to, you know, exploit that and do something that is just absolutely crazy and give no, you know, they could see someone coming to their place of business that they don't know, but maybe they think the person is a threat. Maybe the person isn't a threat at all. And then they're going to shoot that person. I mean, I think, you know, we're supposed to have law enforcement for that purpose.
I was told 10 years ago that Walmart was involved in shadow government. Since then, it's come out in mainstream news that there are 5 FBI agents in Bentonville, Arkansas, at their main computer network 24 hours a day. I had been told by special forces that Walmart will be used and their distribution centers will be used as holding facilities and emergency distribution centers for inoculations. And then, lo and behold, the last 2 years, Walmart has admitted they're involved. And so this is a great way to take over the society. They're using the FEMA emergency centers, known locally as county emergency centers. They now have CIA liaisons in every major city. They have Pentagon people spying on peace groups. Are you aware of the clergy response teams now secretly, and it's now come out, not telling their flock they're on the government payroll and they're paid to go to these classes, but they've gone out to all the big churches, now 20 plus 26,000, and trained them for martial law, and they're telling them what to go tell their flock, how to turn your guns in, how to go to FEMA camps. Were you aware of that?
I was. I heard about this after I finished my story, but this broke in Louisiana with a very mainstream TV network that broke the story, that they interviewed some members of the clergy who were in these so-called clergy response teams. They were being told what to do in times of martial law. They were even being told what chapter and verse from the Bible to read to their flock, to tell people to calm down and wait till the whole thing is over. That's what they're instructed to do.
Boy, I tell you, did you see the fact that Tommy Franks was being paid $455,000 a year for 2 years when he retired in 2004 to go around? Sad, but martial law is what we need after the next attack. But then it came out he was being paid by the White House to say that. That's a little creepy, isn't it, Matt?
Didn't realize he was being paid, but his comment didn't get enough attention in most parts. I mean, he did say after he retired, this is the guy who led the ground forces into Iraq, that if we're attacked again by terrorists with weapons of mass destruction, we're going to have to put the Constitution aside. And then there's Wayne Downing of the National Security Council. He's dead now, but he was Condoleezza Rice's deputy for a couple years. And when he retired, he said, we're going to have to declare martial law someday.
Again, is there any doubt in your mind as a journalist, Matt Rothschild, that they are doing everything they can to try to prepare the police, the corporate leaders to stand up and say everything, the pastors, it's okay, go along with a martial law takeover?
I got to think that not only are the blueprints on the drawing boards, but they're pursuing, you know, in lining people up for what they need to do, and, you know, if push comes to shove.
Did you see the San Francisco Chronicle article by the former congressman 3 weeks ago, finally admitting, Houston Chronicle also, that they are building camps for the American people?
Well, is this the Halliburton story about detention camps?
Yes, but then they expanded into PDD 51 that says Bush is above Congress and now a dictator, and the John Warner Defense Authorization Act actually says for domestic operations against a mass revolt.
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, this May 9th, 2007 National Security Presidential Directive 51 which is entitled National Continuity Policy. I mean, people should look that up and see what powers Bush is grabbing for himself.
Well, here's the problem. We know that they're pushing the Democrats, they're pushing Hillary right now. No doubt Diebold's cheating Obama. That's been coming out. But, I mean, look, this is bigger than Bush. Or do you agree, Matt, that it's just continuing? This infrastructure didn't start, you know, last week. It's not going to go away in a year.
No, I mean, InfraGuard itself started in 1996. So that was under the Clinton administration, and it's just been mushrooming ever since. But it's going to – that infrastructure, those plans for what's going to happen in, under an emergency in a martial law situation will be there after Bush and Cheney leave office.
Now, that's the key. And if you look at it under Reagan, it was, say, 1 inch tall. Now, literally, now it's the size of a redwood sequoia in Northern California. I mean, now it's everywhere. And well, they've got 500,000, and they're going to double that this year. Truck drivers spying on everybody. I mean, this is getting bad.
Yeah, and why isn't Congress going to hold hearings on this? You know, why don't they say, you know, what's up, not only what's up with InfraGuard, but, you know, what are the plans for martial law? What's going to happen to our civil liberties or our democratic system of government in times of martial law? I mean, you know, this is a big, big issue that's looming out there, and our congressional oversight is just not happening.
Well, I'll tell you, the election laws are written to where they can selectively enforce against anybody, and even if you try to be above board. So they, even the good guys know if they buck too much, they'll have a election commission investigation. And most of them have, at least in their 20 years in Congress, you know, gotten seduced by a you know, set up by, you know, lovely lady at a bar. And so, you know, most of them are compromised.
And sometimes, you know, the Bush administration won't give them information. I know Pete DeFazio in Oregon there was trying to find out more information about National Security Presidential Directive 51, and they just told him he couldn't have it.
And then later, you're right, Mr. Rothschild, then later the chairman asked for it, and they said, no, you may have the highest congressional clearance, but Congress isn't allowed to see what we're going to do during an emergency.
Yeah, so, you know, there's your answer. I mean, the system of government is going to go.
What are we going to do? I mean, there's no doubt they've built camps, they're training the police. Now all these people on Fox are saying if you're an anti-war protester or a 9/11 truther, you should be, quote, sent to a secret prison. The military needs to be used against us. I don't know if you've seen those reports. That lets me know that they may be seriously contemplating going for it.
Well, I think, first of all, that your listeners and other citizens in this country should be very worried about what these plans are. And secondly, we need to demand of our congresspeople that they, you know, hold hearings, demand to hold hearings. And if Bush isn't going to give them information, they should go to the courts. And if Bush still is going to stiff arm them, they should impeach him. I think he should be impeached anyway. But this is just another reason. We need to get to the bottom of this, not just to hold Bush and Cheney accountable, but to dismantle this repressive apparatus that's been put in place.
And, folks, it's the most robust we've ever seen. The size of it already dwarfs what the Nazis had via infrastructure. And this is a White House that's written memos saying that they can torture children sexually in front of their parents. So, I mean, there's no doubt they're trying to go for broke.
Yeah, I don't think we should have any illusions that, you know, Bush and Cheney are four square behind this thing. I mean, look at what they've done to our Constitution so far, and they're not going to stop at anything. But I do think this is an issue that demands more mainstream media attention and demands more congressional attention. Otherwise, you know, they're going to declare martial law someday, and it'll be too late.
Well, citizens need, you know, we overthrew the Patriot Act here in Austin. I don't know, 700, 800 cities, 5 states have done it. We need to keep going down. We need to go to city councils, read these news articles out of the San Francisco Chronicle, because that sounds credible. San Francisco Chronicle says they're setting up a dictatorship. You know, point this out, hype an awareness, and you know, even Bob Woodward last year was at a university down in San Antonio and said he's worried about this. That is the good news, though, isn't it, Matt, that a lot of really heavy hitters are now talking about this?
Yeah, the only other one that I remember really talking about was Ted Koppel. He actually had a show on what's going to happen if there's martial law or whether there's a serious chance of it. And the scary thing was he had Democratic foreign policy establishment and domestic intelligence people on, both from the Clinton administration and formerly in Bush, and they both agreed. They all agreed, yeah, if we're attacked again, there's going to be martial law. All they were talking about was how long was it going to be? Is it going to be 2 weeks, 2 months? You know, how long?
See, it's real simple. As PNAC said, they're not, as the vice president wrote, they're not going to be able to keep attacking all these nations and expanding unless there's terror attacks. And then lo and behold, magically there's terror attacks. Boy, isn't that convenient for them, Matt?
Well, they sure seized on it. That there's no question about that. I mean, they seized on 9/11. I mean, I don't buy into the idea that Cheney and Bush were behind 9/11, but I think there were those plans on the shelf, ready to be taken down as soon as the United States was attacked, because, you know, the Project for a New American Century said it's going to take another what? It's going to, you know, it's going to take another huge attack, another Pearl Harbor, to get what they wanted, which is a $500 billion Pentagon budget, which they have right now.
Matt, they've got White House chief counsel saying they can crush children's genitals with pliers, but you don't think they'd, at least at some level, be involved?
I don't think they were competent enough to be involved to carry the thing off, frankly.
But they're competent enough to set up this whole grid.
Well, they're setting up the grid that's just a bureaucracy in motion right now. And, you know, it started with Clinton, it's going on forward. And it went back to Reagan with FEMA, as you pointed out.
We're in deep trouble. Matthew Rothschild is our guest. He's an award-winning journalist. He writes for The Progressive, progressive.org, and he's done a great series of stories on InfraGuard. Final segment with our guest straight ahead. We'll give out any other websites or info he wants to talk about, and talk about more ideas of how to stop this. Get his take when we get back.
Will it ever become a reality in America? Some fear any nuclear, biological, or chemical attack on U.S. territory might trigger just that. NSK's Late News 12 Jeff Farrell discovered that clergy would help the government with potentially their biggest problem, us.
From my cold, dead hands.
Charlton Heston's famous declaration captures a truly American value, the overarching desire to protect our freedoms. But gun confiscation is exactly what happened during the state of emergency following Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. U.S. troops also arrived, something far easier to do even now thanks to last year's elimination of the 1878 Posse Comitatus Act that forbid U.S. troops from policing on American soil. If martial law were enacted here at home, like depicted in the movie The Siege, easing public fears and quelling dissent would be critical. And that's exactly what the clergy response team, as it's called, helped accomplish in New Orleans.
Jeff, the primary thing that we say to anybody is let's cooperate, get this thing over with, and then we'll settle the differences once the crisis is over.
Such clergy response teams would walk a tightrope between the needs of the government versus the wishes of the public.
In a lot of cases, these clergy would already be known in the neighborhoods in which they're helping to defuse that situation.
For the clergy, one of the biggest tools that they will have in helping calm the public down or obey the law is the Bible itself, specifically Romans, Romans 13.
Because the government is established by the Lord, you know, and that's what we believe in the Christian faith. That's what's stated in the Scripture.
Civil rights advocates believe the amount of public cooperation may depend largely on how long they expect the suspension of their rights might last. Jeff Farrell, KSLA News 12 reporting.
According to Tuberville, during Hurricane Katrina, the clergy response team provided 38 chaplains a day around the clock at eight different camps.
Crashing through the lies and disinformation, it's Alex Jones, only on the GCN Radio Network.
Our guest is Matthew Rothschild, journalist. Look, this is about impregnating the leadership of this country and private industry with secret police cronyism and paranoia. You know, leave the borders wide open, but look under every bed, every closet. There's terrorists everywhere. And then in all these FBI and federal programs and local programs, within a year of the program, it starts out sounding reasonable. You know, we're looking for guys around the perimeter of the power plant. Then it moves into the library, spying on what people are reading. And then they move into, quote, fighting crime in this whole tattletale society. Matt Rothschild, getting back into 9/11, and you can look this up for yourself, but everything I brought up you've known about, so it sounds like you're pretty well informed on all this. You probably know more than I do in some facets. But, you know, Bush had 44,000 U.S. troops, 18,000 U.S. troops in Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, four of the stands, ready to invade, two aircraft carrier task forces. On September 10th, he signed launch orders for a week later to launch the attack on Afghanistan. But then we were told that was because of the 9/11 attack. I wonder why they magically had the troops build up in the 4 months before and magically signed the launch order to attack to have that great, you know, rapid response people thought just happened in 5 minutes.
Well, I haven't heard that part, but I don't believe that they were, you know, I mean, to say that Bush and Cheney were behind 9/11, you have to assume that thousands of people were in on this conspiracy. And then how far do you go? I mean, did Cheney tell people to plant bombs under the Twin Towers? And how were they able to go in and do that?
But see, Matt, we don't know. We know they lied to us. We know they basically appointed and ran the commission through Zelikow. And we know that their PNAC documents said, boy, this would sure help if this happened. And you know, they had the Manhattan Project. That was secret. It would only take actually a few hundred people. Again, I'm asking you the question. It's like if a building catches on fire and people report that the fire department was already out front when the fire started, you'd ask, why was the fire department there?
Well, I don't know. I didn't see the stories on this Turkmenistan and that order. But certainly, the Bush administration was planning what to do about Afghanistan anyway. And I don't think they needed a 9/11 to have plans on the border, maybe even orders about what to do about Afghanistan short of 9/11. But, you know, I'll look at that. I have done a lot of study on this 9/11 question. I'm just not convinced that, you know, there was a conspiracy. Certainly, they seized on 9/11.
Well,
that's without question.
Have you seen all the Republican memos and editorials saying we need another 9/11?
Well, I mean, idiots will say idiotic things. I mean, that didn't prove anything to me. I mean, you know, how foolish is that for someone to say after 3,000 people were killed here? But that doesn't mean that Bush did it the first time either.
So you are aware of those stories, though?
Yeah, I saw that.
Okay, well, let's expand on that now that we've gotten off into this issue just briefly. Drills of flying hijacked jets in the World Trade Center and Pentagon the exact same time that morning. Were you aware of that?
I was, yeah.
Just another accident, another strange happening.
Well, it's strange, but it doesn't prove the case. I mean, it's curious.
A new world order.
In the near future, Earth is dominated by power.
Waging war on corruption. Alex Jones on the GCN Radio Network. Mainstream media, government cover-ups. You want answers? Well, so does he. He's Alex Jones on the GCN Radio Network. And now, live from Austin, Texas, Alex Jones.
The dollar continues its slide into oblivion. More details on that coming up as more and more horrible financial news comes out as the earnings reports proliferate. We'll get into every major city with masses of drugs and other cocktails of chemicals and herbicides, pesticides. We'll be covering that. Dr. Dina Delce's conspiracy, none of it exists. The water's delicious and shouldn't even try to clean it. And we got about 3 or 4 minutes left with an individual who is a prolific, award-winning journalist, writes for The Progressive, progressive.org. Got a clip up on Infowars.com of him a few weeks ago. On Democracy Now, really laying it all out. I suggest you spend some time to go watch that. But in closing, sir, and we appreciate your time, your ideas about how to turn this around, obviously educate the public about this grid, but other ideas you've got about stopping this huge military-industrial complex system that's basically running the red light cameras, the face-scanning cameras, the thumb scanning for school lunches. I mean, it's just a whole prison-type grid going in. How do we stop it?
Well, we got to stand up for our rights. There's no doubt about that. And I think you had a good idea earlier on. We can start locally at our city councils, at our county boards, and even with our states. You know, there's something called a Bill of Rights Defense Committee around the country, and they've helped more than 400 cities and towns say they're not going to let the Patriot Act tell them what to do when it's asking for unconstitutional powers. So I think that's one way to organize and educate people on this. Another is to demand of our legislators that they hold hearings on this subject. And we've got to, you know, keep their feet to the fire. Otherwise, you know, the government is going to continue with its plans to, you know, tear up our Constitution even more than it's torn up already.
We've got a few champions, love them or hate them. Waxman might do this. Paul has called for it. So has Dennis Kucinich. Any other ideas in the House or Senate? Because, you know, obviously approach one of them and have them bring it up.
My Senator Russ Feingold is real good on civil liberties issues. Chris Dodd out in Connecticut is good on them, and I think people should pressure them as well. I've tried to get this in front of Feingold, and next time I talk to him, I'm going to try to ask him too.
Well, you know, there's still kind of that kook factor of, oh, there's a secret government. You've got to talk about it when it's now in mainstream newspapers that are calmly reporting how there's FEMA camps. I mean, this is big.
Yeah, and I think that's a real problem that people, you know, they, you know, kind of embarrassed to bring up the subject of InfraGuard or shoot to kill under martial law. I mean, the first time I heard it, I thought the guy was crazy. But then, you know, he showed me his InfraGuard card, and then I talked to other people in this organization who've been told the same thing. And then at some point, you got to say, hey, there's something going on here.
And then the FBI puts out a correction, but then admits, yeah, we told them they could shoot to kill, but, you know, everybody can, you know.
Yeah, that's not exactly a blowing a hole in the story.
No, it's not, but you notice their headline, you know, says, oh, this is pure bull. And then they admit, oh, it's actually all true, but his interpretation is wrong.
Yeah, patently false is what they said, but they couldn't dispute a single fact. They couldn't refute a single allegation that I made in the story.
Well, Matt, I know it's all true because I have been to the urban warfare drills and watched Marines where they hire hundreds of role players. They hire all the local actors. And it doesn't matter if it's New York or California, and they sit there saying, I'm an American, no, not the camp, and they let me videotape mock interrogations where they say, where are you from? I'm from San Francisco. Where'd you get the helmet? Where'd you get the gun? I mean, that was 10 years ago.
Yeah, and I think we have to recognize that they're planning for this, and we have to demand that they stop planning for it, and we've got to assert our rights before it's too late.
We need a congressional study or some think tank study on how much has been spent on all this.
Well, that's another way to look at it. You know, where are they getting the money for this? I mean, there are these, you know, black operations that the CIA and the FBI and the NSA are doing, and why shouldn't we as citizens know about them?
Absolutely. Matt Rothschild, we really appreciate your contributions to all this and the research you've done. Any other websites or personal site you want to plug?
Yeah, people should go to InfraGuardMembers.org to find out more about this, or InfraGuard.net, and go to our website, Progressive.org.
All right. Thanks for spending time with us.
My pleasure.
There goes Matthew Rothschild. We'll come back and into a ton of news, your phone calls, and another huge guest coming up in 55 minutes. The transmission continues.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and welcome, Chairman Bernanke. I am very pleased to be here today as the ranking member, and in the midst of the great optimism of monetary policy and how the economy is doing, I still have some concerns. And, of course, one of my long-term goals has always been to emphasize maintaining the integrity of the monetary unit rather than looking superficially at some of our statistics. But I also share the concern of the chairman of the committee of our responsibilities for oversight and your interest as well, Chairman Bernanke, on having the transparency that I think we all desire. Transparency in monetary policy is a goal we should all support. I've often wondered why Congress has so willingly given up this prerogative over monetary policy. Congress, in essence, has ceded total control of the value of our money to a secretive central bank. Congress created the Federal Reserve, yet it had no constitutional authority to do so. We forget that those powers not explicitly granted to the Congress by the Constitution are inherently denied to the Congress, and thus the authority to establish a central bank was never given. Of course, Jefferson and Hamilton had that debate early on, and the debate seemingly was settled in 1913. But transparency and oversight are something else, and they're worth considering. Congress, although not by law, essentially has given up all its oversight responsibilities over the Fed. There are no true audits. Congress knows nothing of the conversations, the plans, and the action taken in concert with other central banks. We get less and less information regarding the money supply each year, especially now that we don't even have access to M3 statistics. The role the Fed plays in the President's secretive working group on financial markets goes essentially unnoticed by Congress. The Federal Reserve shows no willingness to inform Congress voluntarily about how often the working group meets, what action it takes that affects the financial markets, or why it takes these actions. But all these actions directed by the Federal Reserve alter the purchasing power of our money. And that purchasing power is always reduced. The dollar today is worth only 4 cents compared to the dollar that the Federal Reserve started with in 1913. This has significant consequences on our economy and our political stability. All paper currencies are vulnerable to collapse, and history is replete with examples of great suffering caused by these collapses, especially to the nation's poor and the middle class. This can lead to political turmoil as well. even before a currency collapses, the damage done by a fiat system is significant. Our monetary system insidiously transfers wealth from the poor and the middle class to the privileged rich. Wages never keep up with profits on Wall Street and the banks, thus sowing the seeds of class and discontent. When economic trouble hits, free markets and free trade are often blamed, while the harmful effects of a fiat monetary system are ignored. We deceive ourselves that all is well with the economy and ignore the fundamental flaws that are a source of growing discontent among the various groups. Few understand that our consumption and apparent wealth is dependent on a current account deficit running at approximately $800 billion a year. This deficit shows that much of our prosperity is based on borrowing rather than a true increase in production. Statistics show year after year that our productive manufacturing jobs I think they finally cut me off. Okay. This phenomenon is not seen as a consequence of the international fiat monetary system where the United States government benefits as the issuer of the world reserve currency. Government officials consistently claim that inflation is in check at barely 2%, but middle-class Americans know that their purchasing power, especially when it comes to housing, energy, and medical care and school tuition, is shrinking much faster than at 2% per year. Even if prices are held in check, in spite of our monetary inflation, concentrating on the CPI statistics distracts from the real issue. We must address the important consequences of the Fed manipulation of interest rates. When interest rates are artificially low, below market rates, insidious malinvestment and excessive indebtedness inevitably brings about the economic downturns that everyone dreads. We look at GDP figures and reassure ourselves that all is well, yet a growing number of Americans still do not enjoy the high standard of living that monetary inflation brings to the privileged few. Those who benefit the most are the ones who get to use the newly created credit first.
The gentleman's time has expired. The gentleman would come to a conclusion.
Okay, I will yield back.